So thanks very much, Sangharatna. I appreciate having my long golden hair mentioned. Embarrassing though it is, because one of the things that I want to talk about in the course of this talk is impermanence, and you could hardly have a more concrete example. I could probably just sit down now, the point's been made. Yeah, the retreat was in Nijmegen, and actually the reason I'm here is a few weeks ago I was on retreat with Manju Mitra, who's part of the group that was organising the festival today. We were doing a week's retreat on a text called the Anapanasati Sutta. In a sense, it wasn't really on the text, it was a meditation retreat. But Manju Mitra asked if I would come and do a talk on the Anapanasati Sutta, partly because it's so closely related to the theme today, which is looking at a very similar, or at least a closely related text called the Satipatthana Sutta. The Anapanasati Sutta has been described as the Satipatthana Sutta done as a practice. So it's, in a sense, it covers the same ground, but covers it a bit more succinctly and in a more organised way. There are people who would argue with that as a description, but it's certainly, there's a lot of overlap between the two texts. And I usually cover this text on a week's retreat, and I've done what I could to cram a week's worth of preparation into a single talk. I've been as rigorous and as disciplined as I could. I suspect some of you by the end of the talk might be wishing for a little bit more rigour, but certainly at least get a bit of an overview of the text. And I thought I'd start off really, really basic. It's a Majjhima Nikaya text. I think it's Majjhima Nikaya 119, if I remember. But it's set in a place called Savatthi. It's set in a particular place in Savatthi called the Eastern Monastery. And it's set at the end of the Rains Retreat. So I don't know if you know this, but the tradition in the Buddha's time was that the monks would congregate in particular places for the 3 months of the rainy season, and they would go on retreat, so they'd be practicing even more intensely than they usually were. So the setup here is at the end of the Rains Retreat, the Buddha's having a look at this group of bhikkhus practicing, and he says, "I'm content at heart with this." He's so pleased at what he's seeing. He's looking at this group of people practicing. He's looking at this list of the great and the good of the Pali Canon. There's Sariputra, Modgalyana, Mahakashyapa, Ananda, number of other senior disciples of the Buddha, and they're teaching the younger bhikkhus, teaching them various practices that the text goes through. But they're also teaching one of the particular practices that gets mentioned is the mindfulness of breathing. And the Buddha says, "I'm so pleased about this that I want to give some more teachings on the mindfulness of breathing." And he says that in a month's time, at the next full moon, he'll give a teaching on the mindfulness of breathing. And the way the sutra describes it is word gets out and bhikkhus come from anywhere within walking distance within a month. They come and congregate to hear the Buddha give this teaching. And it's one of the most detailed meditation teachings in the Pali Canon. I think it's one of the few texts that goes through a meditation practice systematically. And there's a number of different sections to the text, but the core of it is this set of 16 verses in the middle. And it's four groups of four verses, basically to do with the four satipatthanas, the four foundations of mindfulness, as they're sometimes called. And the Buddha talks about bringing awareness to the breath and the body, bringing awareness to the feelings, bringing awareness to the mind, and then bringing awareness to the nature of reality. So I want to say something about all four of these. But before I do, just that there's a wee kind of refrain. Before the Buddha starts teaching, he starts to talk about where this practice goes. And what he says is that mindfulness of breathing when developed and pursued, is of great fruit. It's of great benefit. Mindfulness of breathing, when developed and pursued, brings the four satipatthanas to their culmination. The four satipatthanas, when developed and pursued, bring the factors of awakening to their culmination. And the factors for awakening, when developed and pursued, bring clear knowing of the nature of things and release to their culmination. The reason I wanted to mention that is, I think basically it's saying the mindfulness of breathing goes deep. And basically it's a set of conditions that support, in the language of the text, clear knowing and release. It is a practice that's pitching for the final liberation of the mind. And what this practice does is it takes you step by step through connection with the breath to nirvana, basically. So I wanted to say a little bit about this as a practice. One of the things that I like about it is that it's so practical. I mean, it literally does step by step say this is what you would do next. So say a little bit about that. One of the reasons that I wanted to mention that was that Bhante recently wrote a little letter, I suppose you could say, a letter sent to all order members. And he makes a number of points in it. But one of the points that he makes is that one of the ways that he's taught, one of his little aphorisms, is more and more of less and less. And another one of his aphorisms is there are no higher teachings, there are only deeper understandings. And one of the points that he's trying to make is that in the most basic teachings, you've got seeds of spiritual practice that go very deep. And one of the points that he's been trying to make is in the mindfulness of breathing, that there's a practice that's just open-ended, that it starts off with a little bit of calming down, a little bit of concentration, but it goes very deep. So, you know, whether or not there's value in other practices, I'm sure there are, but what one of the practical points that he makes is that people often move to other practices without really fully having managed to engage with the possibilities, the sort of depth that some of the what are seen as foundation practices or basic practices, some of those practices go very deep indeed. So I want to say a little bit in detail about what this text is getting at. Another couple of things though, that I want to bring out from this little introductory section. The monks are on retreat. I mentioned the retreat with Manju Mitra. I still remember the retreat with Sangharatna in 1975. I didn't remember it was 1975, but I remember the retreat. And I suppose one of the points I wanted to make, this might be teaching my granny to suck eggs, but my own experience is retreats are where practice goes deep. And what the monks were doing here, the Buddha was teaching people who had been practicing for a number of years, but more immediately they'd been practicing for 3 or 4 months. They'd been quite intensely engaging with meditation practice for 3 or 4 months, and into that atmosphere the Buddha starts to teach. And I just wanted to put in a word for the value of long retreats as a way of more and more of your attention, more and more of your energy, managing to drop what it is that usually traps it, and managing to focus on the nature of things. I wanted in particular to mention that probably the longest retreats that we do are retreats that are aimed for men and women who've asked for ordination. I did one of those a couple of years ago. And in a way that the structure of the retreat is simplicity itself. We started off looking at ethics. Just, you know, you spend, actually it's a wee bit more confrontational than maybe it sounds. We spent about 2 weeks going through the precepts one by one and telling a small group of people that you'd never actually met before, probably, every time you had seriously broken one of the precepts in your whole life. And there was a couple of moments where I was a little bit embarrassed, I must say. A couple of moments where I was seriously paranoid, having just disclosed stuff that I'd gone to a lot of trouble not to tell any about for my whole life. But it started off just looking at ethical practice and just the impact over a couple of weeks that had on your mind, just your sensitivity to how what you do, what you say and what you think, the impact that that has on your experience, just after a couple of weeks, a little bit sensitised to that. Doing a fair bit of meditation. Then we did some study, and the study was on the lakshanas. Lakshanas, if you don't know, are the all conditioned experiences, impermanent, insubstantial and unsatisfactory. I'm going to say a little bit more about that later, but again, absolutely basic Buddhism. And then we did a couple of weeks looking at our experience in meditation based on that. And by this time we're 6 weeks, 7 weeks into a retreat. And just that, you know, the kind of cumulative impact of looking at your behaviour, some of the key ideas, just being reminded that your experience is impermanent, and then looking in meditation at what your mind is, and having nothing else much to do apart from the odd bit of cooking, or cleaning out the toilets, that sort of thing. But apart from those, just that careful attention being brought to what's most significant and most spiritually significant in your experience. And there's something in that careful attention that I think it's hard to reproduce in a daily practice. It's not that daily practice isn't important, I think it's crucial, but experience goes deeper in these retreat situations. And I just wanted to put a plug in. Like, over the last few years, it used to be if you were going to get ordained, it was mandatory. You went on one of these long retreats. In the last few years, it's become much more flexible than that, which I think is a good thing. Not everybody's free to go on a 3 or 4 month retreat. But if you are free to go, it's such an opportunity to take your practice deeper that don't miss it. Like, the first time that I did it was in 1985, and I gave up a job to go and do this retreat. And on balance, I would recommend that, actually. If you had to weigh up which was the more important, teaching in a graphic design college in Bournemouth, for example, or going on a 4 month retreat, I'd go for the retreat. Anyway, whether or not, again, it's a wee bit of a diversion, but you've got the bhikkhus, this big group of practitioners, 4 months into serious engagement with practice, and into that context, into that sort of atmosphere, the Buddha gives this teaching. He does a little preamble, and then he goes into the core of the text. This is what I'm going to spend most of the time on. And even here, I have to pick, like, you could easily give a talk on any one at least of these groups of verses. So I'm going to try and cover quite a lot of ground, so please bear with me. But the start of the instruction on mindfulness of breathing starts off with this group of 4 verses. And the Buddha says, breathing in long, one notices, and breathing in long. Breathing out long, one notices, and breathing out a long breath. Breathing in a short breath, a notice, and breathing in a short breath. Breathing out a short breath, a notice, and breathing out a short breath. And then the first set of verses says, one trains oneself. Sensitive to the whole body, I breathe in, I breathe out. Calming the whole body, I breathe in, and I breathe out. So I want to say something just about this set of verses first of all. If I'm teaching this on retreat, even with people who've done a lot of meditation, partly learning from my own experience when I did this practice, was I'll give quite a lot of emphasis on just being sure you're actually connecting with the breath. I'd been practicing, I think, for 20 years when I did a little exercise with Tejananda, who got us to sit down and just to notice where you first experienced the breath, to notice how long each breath is. Now, what that means is sort of noticing if you're able to just be there and attentive at the start of the breath and still connected to it at the end of the breath. One of the quite good gags that I got from another meditation teacher that I tend to use on retreats was from Joseph Goldstein, who says it's an unrealistic demand to make on people to ask them to be aware for a whole breath. So he recommends just do a half breath. Right. If you can contact the start of an in-breath, and if you're still there at the end of the in-breath, that's success. Right. And then have a little break and do it. Do the same for the out-breath. Right. So just that that the learning how to actually be in touch with simple experience. I think this is the start of Buddhist teaching. It's like we don't connect to our experience. And what you're learning, first of all, in this practice, is just how to make connection with a simplest experience. And what's great about it is that it's a transferable skill. Right? If you can start to do that, as you see in the rest of the practice, you learn how to connect to how you're feeling. You learn how to notice what your mind's doing. But you start off just with this absolutely basic moment of experience. What's it like to breathe in? What's it like to breathe out? Are you able to stay with your attention just connected to that? So that's the start of the practice. And I'd usually spend a couple of days on that, right, just so you can get the hang of it. The Buddha then goes on, one trains oneself, sensitive to the whole body, I breathe in, sensitive to the whole body, I breathe out, and calming the whole body, I breathe in and breathe out. I want to say something about this. There are two things I want to say, actually. The first thing is about this idea of training. I think that there's a really crucial bit of teaching from the Buddhist tradition in this idea of training. Quite often, one of the terms that's used to refer to practitioners is sekko. And sekko just means that you're in training. You're learning how to work with your own mind. And traditionally, everybody short of enlightenment is described as sekko. We're in training up until the moment that we're arahats. And this idea of training is, I think, quite a kind of key idea in Buddhism. And one of the core things is how you turn what you know into experience. In a sense, that's what you're trying to do with any Buddhist practice. A book I was reading recently by a man called Jonathan Haidt, and he uses this image that he gets from Borges, who has this story called The Library. And in this library, there's an infinite number of books. And they know that somewhere in this infinite number of books is a book that explains how the library got to be there and what its purpose is. But they despair of ever finding it. And what Haidt is saying is we live in that library. You live in this torrent of information where you're finding out something else every moment. Our attention's caught moment by moment with new input. What Haidt says is, you've probably already heard the thing that's going to transform your life, but you didn't spend long enough on it. That there's probably nothing else that you need to know, but what we need to do is to take some of those key ideas and just to think through, what does this mean in terms of our experience? And Ryokan's got this nice little gag about it, where in one of his poems he says, "Listen, I'll tell you a secret." And there's the dramatic, poetic pause, and he says, "Everything's impermanent." And there's the wee anticlimax. You know that everything's impermanent. But what this practice is trying to do is to get what you know to be felt, lived, visceral experience that we act out of, respond out of, live out of. So that's where this heading's going. Another point that Haidt makes, Haidt's an American sort of research psychologist looking at how the mind works, basically. He's a meditator and starting to do sort of quite good research into how meditation works. But one of the points that he makes is that change is slow. He talks about peak experiences and says you can have peak experiences, you can have quite dramatic experiences, but what research tends to suggest is that dramatic experiences don't last long. Again, he's writing about retreat experience. He says you can have a retreat experience where you really feel you've seen something deeply significant. And he says for most people that'll last for 3 or 4 weeks maximum before the old habits start to reassert themselves. And the analogy that Haidt uses, he gets from the Dhammapada, and it's an image in the Dhammapada of a rider on an elephant. And basically, what Haidt is saying is you can see where you're trying to go, that you're riding an elephant that's got its own ideas of where it would like to go. And what your practice is you as a directing rider becoming skillful enough to persuade the elephant to be heading in line with the deeper value. So just take it as a metaphor, but that what's being said is that there are deep habits built up over a lifetime, from a Buddhist tradition, built up over longer than a lifetime, that you're just starting to work with. And actually, patience is appropriate. You don't have to do it all at once. In fact, anything that happens dramatically probably isn't going to be sustainable. Those moments of clear seeing are of real value, but then you have to learn how to work with those deep habitual energies. How do you bring about that deeper, slower, more careful change? And basically that's what practice is. One of the key things, again, according to Haidt, is repetition. That a moment where you see something clearly once is going to have an impact. Seeing something clearly again, and then seeing it clearly again, and then seeing it clearly again, and gradually you get it, gradually the elephant gets it. And what this practice is doing is just teaching you how to bring attention to what's significant, not just at random, not just once, but teaching you how to do it carefully, reliably, again, and then to do it again, and then to do it again. So let's go on to the text. Start off with awareness of the breath. The next thing is that you bring awareness to the breath in the body, sensitive to the whole body. I breathe in, I breathe out. And the point that's been made there, I guess, is just that you're using the breath as an anchor and you're gradually allowing it to move out to cover the whole of your experience. You could say quite a lot about awareness of the body. I have to say, it's not my specialist subject on the whole. I think, if you'll forgive me referring and blaming my conditioning, a Scottish Protestant background doesn't give you great, skilled, detailed access to your physical experience. But the point that a number of teachers make, like Goenka, for example, says that all of your experience is accessible through your body. In a sense, like, one way of seeing yourself is that you're an organism. It's not that you have an emotional experience and that has a physical consequence. It's like the same experiences play themselves out on different levels of our being. And you bring attention to the body, you notice tensions. Quite often they're pointing to little places where the mind's caught. So you're starting off again with the simplest, most direct, most grounded, most embodied, like literally embodied experience, is starting to be aware of the body. And the next point that's made, the next instruction, is calming the body. There's something, again, in this, I think, that's very important. What's being said here, you get this from a lot of the kind of commentarial material on this text, but it's that awareness has an impact. So it's not that you become aware of the body and you've then got to calm it. It's that the awareness itself is a condition that tends to mean the body calms. I don't know if you've noticed this or done any sort of meditation at all, but you become aware of the breath. And what tends to happen is the breath calms down, the breath gets a little bit more even, it gets slower, it gets deeper, it gets finer. And the more concentrated you get, the finer and more subtle the breath tends to become. And just this idea that awareness in your experience itself is transformative is important, I think. And this idea as well that awareness in one element of your experience gives birth, again, almost naturally to the another unfolding element of the experience. One of the writers in this text, called Buddhadasa, describes each of the 16 verses as having a lawful relationship to each other. So the if you're aware of the breath, it tends to calm. This is what Buddhadasa means by a lawful relationship. You're aware of the body, your body tends to relax. Now, again, I don't want to be too mechanistic about it, because actually sometimes it's anything but. You sit down, you meditate, you're aware of your body, and you've got bedlam going on. You know, similarly, if you're aware of your mind. So it's not mechanistic, but there's something in that act of attention itself that sets a process naturally, without you having to push it along too much. That tends to mean the body calms down a little bit. So that's the just that key idea that I want to get in, that awareness has a transformative effect, and awareness on one bit of your experience impacts on what happens more deeply. So let's start to go a little bit more deeply. The second set of verses start off again with this idea, one trains oneself. So just this idea, it's not going to happen all at once. It's not that you're going to hear this talk and your experience is going to be transformed. What's happening is just your attention is being pointed towards something. So one trains oneself. Sensitive to piti, I breathe in, I breathe out. Piti gets translated sometimes as pleasure or rapture. Sensitive to sukha, I breathe in and breathe out. The sukha gets translated as bliss. I'll say a little bit more about this in a minute. Third verse is one trains oneself. Sensitive to, Larry Rosenberg translates it as mental processes. The actual word is chitta sankara in Pali. Let's go with mental processes for the time being. I'll say a little bit more about chitta sankara. Sensitive to mental processes, I breathe in and breathe out. Calming mental processes, I breathe in and breathe out. Something I want to say about the broad pattern of this, if you go through 16 stages, it can sound like quite a lot. Actually, you've got more or less the same pattern going on in these four different areas. You're aware of the body, you connect with it, you give it some space, and it settles. You're aware of the feelings, you connect with them, you give them some space, and they settle. You're aware of what's going on in your mind, you connect with it, you give it some space, and it settles. It's the same basic pattern, just repeated on subtler and subtler levels of experience. That I find that quite a helpful way of understanding this text. But anyway, what we're doing here is looking at this fourfold, or these four verses on feelings. And the first thing that's being said is this idea of sensitive to piti, sensitive to pleasure, sensitive to rapture. A couple of points that's been made here, and maybe the most important one is, a lot of the time there's positive experience going on and we miss it. In a sense, you've got this field of experience and your attention goes to certain things. And your attention habitually goes to certain things. There's a whole advertising industry out there paying intelligent, skilled people to make sure your attention goes to certain things. And what's being said here is there are elements in your experience that are significant that we don't always habitually notice. And what you've been asked to do here is to notice them. Again, let's just go back to meditation practice. But what's being said is you're aware of the breath, it'll calm down. If you're aware of the breath and the body tends to relax. The body relaxing is pleasurable. The breath becoming a little subtler is pleasurable. The mind starting to settle a little bit is pleasurable. And just starting to notice what it's like to be a bit more deeply connected to yourself and for your body to start to recognise that it's pleasurable. One of the things that you're doing in the practice, one of the real eye-openers for me is often the pleasure's there, right? But just it's the taking of my attention to it that lets me notice it for the first time. I just notice my body's a wee bit more open than it was 5 minutes before. And it's just without me having to make any big judgment about it. I like it. I like it that my body's not as tense. I like it that I've got a bit more kind of room to move in. So what you've been asked to do in the practice here is just to notice that emotional flavour of the experience. And the instruction in the practice is that you allow the breath to move to the background and you allow the pleasure itself to become a wee bit more foregrounded in your awareness. Again, it's subtle. You're not trying to squeeze pleasure out of your experience. You're just being attentive to what's there, just sort of noticing it. So then you get this idea of sukha. And all that sukha is the wee moment of pleasure that you get of the body releasing with a bit more awareness in it. You settle the first moment of excitement where you think, oh my God, this is nice. That starts to settle and you just settle into that stable connection with yourself. Again, this has implications way beyond sitting practice. You know, the possibility of living your life with that sort of stable, still depth of connection to yourself is quite an attractive option. I think you just have to get a sense of it. But anyway, that's what you're being pointed to in this verse. And this idea of that often you don't notice what's there. There's a little verse again from another Majjhima Nikaya text that says, whatever we attend to becomes the inclination of our mind. So just starting to be a bit more alive to that strand in your experience that's relaxed, calm, finding pleasure in being connected to your experience. One writer says that awareness has intrinsically a feeling of well-being to it. It's almost like it doesn't matter what you're aware of. If you're aware of happiness, there's an obvious sense of well-being. A bit less obviously, if you're connected to your own grief, there's a sense of well-being in that. There's something about that sense of wholeness, of you present to and alive in your experience, that has its own intrinsic sense of this is what I'm supposed to be doing, this is what life is supposed to be like. So what this sukha is pointing to is that quality of connection. And just this idea of you being asked to attend to it, and what the mind learns to attend to becomes the inclination of the mind. Emerson, I think, says somewhere that you don't judge a person by a single act. You judge a person by the tendency of their behaviour, the tendency of their life. And that's how you really get a sense of the quality of somebody's being. So again, back to this idea of a practice. It doesn't matter if your meditation is all over the place. It's just this learning to bring attention to this quality of feeling experience. So first two verses, sensitive to piti, sensitive to sukha, and you're still connected to the breath. Trouble is, you don't always have piti and sukha as the main element of your experience. Again, going back to the retreat I had recently with Manju Mitra, there was at least one time where I said something to somebody that I really wished afterwards I hadn't. I'm sitting down in the next meditation and I'm trying to be attentive to piti and sukha, and what I'm mainly aware of is this deep desire to put my head in my hands and just hide. And the third verse is this idea of sensitive to mental processes. So not just that you're noticing if piti and sukha are there, but it's bigger than that. Your experience isn't always that tidy. So next thing you're being asked to do is just have an attention to what's actually going on. And really, if you bring your attention to your feelings, what's happening right now? And you get this very interesting thing, again, just going back to what happened in that retreat, this experience of, first of all, the disturbance of it. We'd been doing the day before, we'd been talking about dhyana, and Dhammaloka had done some very, very sort of nice, subtle teaching. He was using this idea of you always move towards the centre of your experience. So you had people just noticing if there was pleasure there, and then just very subtly move towards the centre of the pleasure. You get this amazing experience of your mind's capacity to just soak itself in what it's paying attention to. So we'd had this day of really kind of slightly blissing out in your own bliss. So the next day, I was looking forward to doing that again. And actually what I mainly had was remorse. So I'm sitting there with this experience of disturbance, this experience of remorse, and I realise it's the same instruction, just move towards the centre of it. And as you move towards the centre of it, the whole thing is a bit more fluid, a bit more alive, a bit more in the process of unfolding itself than immediately seems obvious. And just this very interesting experience of, first of all, just feeling the fluidity of energy and remorse, realising that in the remorse there was elements that were really healthy, just a sort of real regret for having hurt somebody, a real wish to make connection. And surprise, surprise, the remorse was as reliable a route to dhyana as the piti was. So just being that open to what the energy was, that willing to connect with it, and that willingness to be available to it, and you're just moving into the same quality of you know, close, connected, whole, attentive experience. So the third instruction is just this one, sensitive to mental processes. And the fourth one is calming mental processes. And again, I hope you get a wee bit of a sense from that last verse of what this means. It's not that you're having to force your feelings to calm down. It's that in that bringing of attention to it, you allow them to become more fluid. Again, like Prakasha, who's a retreater who's I was on quite recently, says basically feelings just want to be felt. That if you're willing to be attentive to something, you allow it to flower, and you allow it to fit your... The language that comes from the particular tradition he was talking about was the self-liberating nature of feeling. If you're not resisting it, you're not going to act it out, you're not being overpowered by it, but you're just willing to bring the same careful attention to what you feel as you do to the breath, you let this whole fluid, self-liberating process start. So that's the feelings verses. I want to say something about this idea of mental processes, citta sankara. What's being said here is that feelings shape the mind. Citta sankara just means that which shapes the mind. And what's being said is that usually, almost automatically, there's a technical measurement in the Abhidharma that says that the distance between you having a feeling and you starting to react to it with craving or aversion is 1/64th of a finger snap. So in a 1/64th of a finger snap, usually we hang on to or push away. And Larry Rosenberg is a great example. He says, you're sitting in meditation and there's a noise outside. Say it's traffic noise. Give you a great one, right? You're in a room that's starting to get hot. And your attention is being pulled between what you know is of spiritual value and the fact that you're starting to sweat a little bit. So far, it's just experience. Right? Well, Rosenberg's example is traffic noise. You hear traffic noise. So far, it's just experience. Then you go, you emphasise the noise part of it. So you start to kind of polarise around the experience. And then the next part is you want to know, whose fault is this? Why is this happening to me? Why does this always happen to me? So you've got just a simple experience that you can shut off, or you don't have to shut it off, you can just listen to the traffic noise. Or you can go to, I don't like traffic noise, or you can get into this whole story about the traffic noise. And what he's saying is, what you're being asked to do here is notice the 1/64th of a finger snap that gets you going from noise to whose fault is this? And just go back to the noise. You don't have to shut off. You can just be available to what's unpleasant. You can be equally available to what's pleasant. But just that capacity of the mind to be with experience without having to set up a story about it. I want this to carry on. I wish this wasn't happening. Just coming back to what is the experience. And that's what the calming is. The calming's not that you make the feelings go away. It's just that capacity to notice what's happening without getting caught in the reactions to it, that tightening up of I hope this carries on, or that cramping of I wish this wasn't happening, sort of the pushing away that you get of something. So what you're getting here is the starting to be aware of whatever it is that's going on at a feeling level, you move towards it, you're moving to the centre. You're allowing it to be in awareness. It doesn't matter how turbulent it is. If you're able just to be available to it, your mind's calm without making it go away. So that's what's been said in this. The next four verses I'm going to deal with more briefly. Right, I can't do what I want to do in the whole sutta. So the next verses follow on, again, this lawful relationship of you start to be sensitive to mental processes, you start to notice how your mind habitually reacts, you're able just to be with the experience, and this becomes the citta sankara, this shapes what your experience becomes. So the next set of verses move on to you noticing the quality of mind. And what the verses say is that one trains oneself sensitive to the mind I breathe in and breathe out. Sensitive, gladdening the mind, I breathe in and breathe out. Steadying the mind, I breathe in and breathe out. And liberating the mind, I breathe in and breathe out. And as I say, I'll deal with these a little more briefly. One way into it, actually, is a set of metaphors that come from another tradition, from the Tibetan tradition, that they use this set of metaphors called the Four Remainings. But basically, the Four Remainings are just more poetic ways of talking about the Satipatthanas. So the first of the Four Remainings is that you remain with your body like a mountain. Just this idea of you're connected to it, it's stable, you're grounded. The second of the Four Remainings is remaining with the heart open, like a child gazing in wonder across the ocean. This is the most sort of expressive that it gets. So just this idea of you're seeing something you've never seen before and you're absolutely available to it. Whatever comes out of the water, you're interested in. So that's the second remaining. And the third one, maybe a more familiar image, is remaining with the mind like a blue sky. So if you've been able to be with the feelings, if you haven't moved to grasping, if you haven't moved to pushing away, you've got this sense of the mind spacious, the mind not caught in experience. So the third of the fourth remainings is this idea of the mind remaining with the mind like a blue sky. And this idea of gladdening the mind, it's just, what's it like when your mind's not caught up in what it is that usually disturbs it? Well, one of the things that you've been asked to do in this part of the practice is, if you take this blue sky image, usually we're caught in the clouds. The particular feeling that we're having is what bothers us. The particular thing that we're worried about is what bothers us. That's where our attention is. And Sogyal Rinpoche tells this great story of him and one of his teachers being approached by somebody at a time that really was not suitable. And this person asking Sogyal Rinpoche's teacher what meditation was. And the teacher being a bit irritated, so the questioner persisting. And finally, the teacher says, okay, so you know if you're thinking? And the questioner says, yeah, I know when I'm thinking. And the teacher says, you know that gap in between thoughts? And the guy says, yeah, I know the gap in between thoughts. The teacher says, well, what you do is you take that gap and you make it longer. And that's what meditation is. And basically, that's what this thing of citta is getting at, that you're taking attention off the clouds that we're usually caught in, and you're just starting to notice the space that the whole thing happens in. You're aware of the sky rather than aware of the clouds. And that moment when you do that, that sense of spaciousness that you get when you're not so caught, that's what gladdening the mind is. Just that wee recognition that you don't have to be trapped, you don't have to be caught in your own habits. Just that little first glimpse that you get when the clouds part and you see the blue sky is gladdening the mind. You're not caught in the habit of pushing away or hanging on, so the mind's steady. And because you're not caught, the mind's liberated. So that's the process that you're going through in this one. Slightly rushing that, because I want to spend more time on the fourth tetrad. And the fourth tetrad is that you bring this sensitive, glad, steady, liberated mind to start to look at the nature of all of your experience. And the verse says, one trains oneself. So again, it's not going to happen all at once. You're just learning where your attention has to go. But one trains oneself, focusing on impermanence. I breathe in, I breathe out. Focusing on fading away. I breathe in, I breathe out. Focusing on cessation, I breathe in and breathe out. Focusing on relinquishment, I breathe in, I breathe out. This is really, really core Buddhist teaching. We're back to the Ryokan joke. And the difference is, this time you're not just hearing that Buddhism teaches about impermanence. You're connected to your body. You're open to how you feel. Your mind's got space around that, and it's not caught. You've got this careful, concentrated, joined-up attention. and you're bringing the mind that still and that attentive, again, just to notice something that quite often we miss. And the first thing you're having your attention brought to is the impermanence of all of your experience. So again, if you know anything about Buddhism, you know this. Buddhism says everything in our experience is impermanent. Nagabodhi, I think, gave one of the most eloquent descriptions of that I've ever heard, that Aryaloka a couple of years ago. He says it's true of everything. He says it's, I should get you to tell it actually, but true of universes, it's true of mental states, it's true of pizza. He said. I was walked into the kitchen as I got here, saw a little bit of green and black wrapping paper. I opened it and the chocolate was liquid. Even there, even green and black chocolate, the law of impermanence holds. Now, it's interesting, this, forgive me for repeating a gag, anybody who's heard any of my talks before, but you know it that you don't know it. The great Woody Allen gag that I'm going to repeat. One of the interviewers says, what do you want people to be saying about you 100 years from now? Mm-hmm. And he said, I want people to be saying, doesn't he look great for his age? So somewhere you know it, but not yet quite in every atom of your being. So you're just being asked to bring attention to impermanence. Now, I find myself even doing it as I was going through the list. Impermanence, fading away, cessation and relinquishment. Buddhism didn't always do great PR, great philosophy, but I don't know how you find this, but you listen to that set of adjectives and it might not yet be uplifting. So I think it wants a little bit of interpretation. What came to mind when I was thinking about this actually to begin with was an architectural metaphor for this. A few years ago I went to Borobudur in Java, I think, and it's this big Buddhist stupa, and it's, I think, an architectural expression of what you're trying to do in meditation. And what you do is you walk around these big high walls of the lower sections, and they're beautiful, that they're, every wall is covered in friezes of the Buddha's life story, or previous lives and life stories. Beautifully done, very beautiful, very engrossing. But you're in these high walls and you're completely caught in this experience. Now and again you turn a corner and you get a glimpse of the blue sky above the walls. Anyway, sooner or later you've done the whole circuit. You maybe do it again, get the pictures again because there's two sides. But then you want to go up to the next level. And to do it, you notice there's a gateway. And the gateway has the jaws of death. Right? They've literally done it. So that there's a couple of little eyes, a couple of big fangs hanging over the portal of the door, and you have to walk into the jaws. And it's done very nicely, it's very humorous, it's very endearing image of the jaws of death. But you have to step into it. So you're caught in these big walls, you step through the jaws of death, you walk up a few stairs and you're out into this platform with no walls. And what you're looking at is blue sky in every direction. You're surrounded by Buddhas and the distance you've got the hills. And it's this real bit of architectural theatricality. You're constrained, you're fascinated, but you're held in. You walk into this image, this metaphor for impermanence, and the whole thing just opens up. And basically, that's what this practice is pointing to. What you're asked to do, really practically, is just to go back through everything that you've been attentive to up until now. So you just come back to the breath, and this time, instead of just notice the beginning of the end, you're just noticing that it's impermanent. You're just watching this thing coming into being and passing. And then you're just asked to do the same for everything. So you just notice the experience of the body being a bit tense, and you watch it relax, and you realise you haven't got this one thing called relaxation. What you've got is this very subtle flow of muscles tightening, muscles loosening, tension held, tension released. The whole thing is just this living flow of experience. Same with the feelings. You have the piti, that's a little bit more intense, then it's a little bit less intense, then you lose connection with it, then you get it very strongly, then it stills and moves into sukha, then you've got no idea what you were paying attention to, you're having a completely different train of thought. You're just watching the fluidity of what, in a way, you generalised about by calling it sukha. You're just starting to notice what a flow it is. Now, the surprising thing is that in that noticing, the whole thing becomes more alive, not less alive. It's not that you lose anything at all. It's that as you start to be aware of this unfolding into consciousness of your physical experience, your feeling experience, what's going on in your mind, it's the experience of living more vividly, more fluidly, less constrained than we ever do. Just this idea that I've started to notice the impermanence of something. It's not some kind of bad news. Impermanence is the nature of life, if you don't mind me saying that. And by bringing attention to impermanence, what you're doing is you're opening up to what it's like to have life flow around us and through us. Little verse from Tsongkhapa, where he says, "This life you must know is as the tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being." And I think both of those are true. The idea that it disappears as soon as it comes into being is really spiritually important. The idea that it's a thing of beauty is really spiritually important. That what you're opening up to is something that as you make yourself available to the flow of it, becomes more and more beautiful. And that part of seeing its beauty is seeing the transience of it. But the transience and the beauty aren't two separate things. It's just two sides of the same experience. So you're stepping into the joys. You're out of the walls. You're into this blue sky. The next verse, so first of all, you're noticing the impermanence. And again, just this idea that it's a training. Right? It's not that every meditation is going to be this experience of opening up. Sometimes you're never even going to get past trying to be aware of the in and out breath. But now and again, your awareness comes to something much subtler. And you're seeing that within the breath, there's this flow. Within the feelings, this flow. Within what your mind's doing, this flow. And then the last verse that I want to give a little bit of time to is this second verse that you focus on fading away. You breathe in and you breathe out. Now, fading away is a translation of a Pali word, viraga. And viraga, V is a negative prefix, so it means not. And raga means attached. So viraga just means that you're not attached. And what's being said here is that in the first stage, you're starting to notice this flow of experience. And as you start to notice, you cannot possibly hold it or freeze it. You let it go. And viraga is just that process of letting go. It sometimes gets translated as disentanglement. So it's not that you're moving from less experience or more experience to less experience. It's not that you're giving up, in a sense, anything at all. It's just realising that you've been caught within walls and that it's possible to be wide open to the experience and not caught. So the viraga is what your mind is like when it's still, when it's available to your experience, whatever it is, but it's not tangled up in the experience. You're not identified with this object or that object or this response or that response. It's just this sense of spaciousness that the whole thing unfolds within, but there's nothing cut off about it. It's just the mind when it's not caught, the mind when it's not trapped, in this sense of the mind disentangling and taking a step back into something more spacious. It's tempting to say something a little bit about this. It's a temptation the Buddha resisted. I remember reading Bhante when I was on the Gukhyaloka retreat and being really struck by a point where Bhante says people underestimated the Buddha's sophistication and his deliberate philosophical reticence. So there were certain things that the Buddha just didn't want to talk about. And it wasn't that it was an attempt to keep something secret. It's that what he was talking about, you can't but misconstrue. So the experience of letting go, we usually hear from the point of view of a deep habit of wanting to hold on. So the experience of letting go sounds like a loss. And actually, once you start to get, you get it very, very simply. When you're aware of the breath and you're not resisting it, you just allow it to flow. It's a liberation. It's a step into being more alive. And that happens on deeper and deeper levels. Now, I guess, especially doing the six element practice, just this experience of all of the things that you usually hold on to, when you let them go, the fear is that you're not going to have them anymore. The fact is, you've still got them, but you're not caught by them. There's this enormous space around them. Not only that, but you start to notice, the awareness itself and how you think, I'm having a good meditation, I'm getting concentrated, I'm doing this well, this is getting pretty exciting, and you just let all that go. So what it's like when the mind isn't, I suppose the phrase is holding to nothing, whatever. From the point of view of the habit of holding on, it sounds like a loss. From even the little bits of experience that you've got already, of what it's like when you allow something to be as it is, it's a liberation. So what this last verse is getting at is just noticing the impermanence of everything. And if it's impermanent, why try to hold it? And if you're not holding it, you're not caught in it. And what's that experience like? And the third verse says it's the experience of cessation. But cessation is literally here the word nirodha. And nirodha is what you get in the third noble truth. It's the cessation of the suffering caused by clinging. So it's the mind not disturbed anymore by the absolutely useless attempt of trying to hold what can't be held. And just able to be with experience as it is in itself. And the mind realising its own capacity to do that, what that's like. At this point, I should be following the Buddha's advice, and just, the Buddha said less than this, and there's probably good reasons for that. And I guess what I want to finish up with is this thing again of a practice. You're being asked to bring attention to your experience as it is. Basically, what you're getting at now is impermanence. Later tradition called impermanence emptiness. But emptiness isn't some object of experience. You get this idea in the Heart Sutra, in apart from emptiness, no form, apart from form, no emptiness. You know how the verse goes yourselves. But that there's no emptiness somewhere as an object of experience. What you're looking at is in the midst of the breath, this open, unrestricted flow of experience. In the middle of the specific feelings, the deeper you look, the more open, fluid, unlimited, unrestricted your experience is. The mind, when it's not clinging, just this sense of its own spaciousness, its own lack of restriction. The emptiness isn't something different from your body, your feelings, what your mind's doing, where your attention's going. So coming back to this thing about the practice, is there's nothing abstract about this. I'm not trying to persuade you about the beauty of emptiness. What you've got is the Buddha saying, bring attention to your experience. And it's this fantastic practice. It's this practice that's saying is, if you're out of touch with your body and your body's tense, the practice is make connection and your body will relax. If you're out of touch with your feelings, the practice is make connection and just you start to notice the pleasure in being open to your own vitality. You start to notice the mind's capacity to be with whatever your experience is and to be stable in relationship to that. You're starting to notice if your mind's a little bit confused, that you can let go of the confusion into clarity. You can let go where you get caught and where you get trapped and just move back into something more spacious. And out of that spacious mind, if that's where your attention is, you can just bring attention to the fluid, open, unrestricted nature of it. But the basic point I want to make is that you're bringing attention to experience as it is. It's the same practice. You're attentive, the attention creates the space, and in that space, the deeper nature of something starts to disclose itself. What you've been asked to do is not convince yourself about the deeper nature, but just start to set up this tendency, this training of bringing your attention to your experience as it is. One of the definitions of enlightenment that I heard once from the Zen tradition, somebody was asked to describe enlightenment, and they said, basically, it's that your nose is in the middle and your eyes are on either side. And what you're being asked to do in this practice is just start to learn how to bring attention to what was in front of your nose all of the time.